Stallion. I can resign the quartet. Don Diego, the people will be speaking the name of Zorro again.
You think stealing a horse and scratching marks on the wall makes you worthy enough to wear that mask?
Be careful.
You're a thief, Alejandro. A pitiful clown. Zorro was a servant of the people. He was not a seeker of fame like you. A buffoon. Zorro did what was needed.
Now he's needed again. I didn't ask for your help in the cantina, but I came here to learn how to fight like you, to have your strength, your courage. Now when I try to use them, you slap me down. Let me tell you something. I am tired of all your training, your lecturing. I am tired of waiting for you to tell me I am ready. I have my own scars to settle, a new life to find. I thought I could do it here, but I was wrong.
Leandro! Anga!
Choose your weapon. Montero has invited every don in California to a banquet at his hacienda. If you want to be of service, you can join them as a spy.
I think I do not understand, sir.
You have passion, Alejandro, and your skill is growing. But to enter Montero's world, I must give you something which is completely beyond your reach.
Yes? And what is that?
Charm.
And what is that?
Convince Montero that you're a gentleman of stature, and he will let you into his circle.
Me? A gentleman? This is going to take a lot of work.
Yeah.
Welcome to the Superhero Cinephiles podcast. I'm your host, Perry Constantine. So there's a little bit of a schedule change. I had mentioned the last episode that we were doing a trio of Batman movies, but that one actually got delayed. But instead, we've got something kind of similar to Batman. We're talking about one of the precursors and another one of the pulp characters. And when we're talking pulp heroes, figured you might as well bring back the guy who knows a lot about it, and that's John Brunning. John, how you doing today?
I'm good, Perry. How about yourself?
Doing pretty good. So, like I said, today we're talking about Zorro films, and you had emailed me about doing a few different ones, and the one that really jumped out to me was one of the most recent ones, and that's 1998's The Mask of Zorro with Antonio Banderas, Anthony Hopkins, Catherine Zeta-Jones, and directed by Martin Campbell. But before we jump too much into the movie, why don't you tell me a little bit about what your connection with this character is?
Well, certainly he's a pulp character, and one of the earlier ones, actually. He goes all the way back to, he first appeared as the lead character in a pulp story called The Curse of Capistrano, which was in All Story Weekly, written by Johnston McCulley, and that was in 1919. And he continued to write numerous Zorro stories all the way into the 1950s, I think. And then when he was done, a lot of other writers have picked up the mantle since then and have written a number of stories to the present day. If I'm not mistaken, I think Moonstone Books is currently getting ready to publish a Zorro story by my publishing partner at Flinch Books, Jim Beard. I don't know when exactly when it's coming out, but I think it's coming out sometime in the next few months. So clearly the Zorro legacy continues for a little over a century now. So,
right.
So yeah. And the thing that always struck me about Zorro, is that he is very similar to the Scarlet Pimpernel, which was not necessarily a pulp character, but he was the title character in a very influential 1905 novel by Baroness Orczy.
Yeah.
And very much an influence on Zorro, I believe, in that he was, the Scarlet Pimpernel was on the surface a sort of foppish and unmanly figure and often regarded with contempt by the other male characters in the story, but his secret identity was very much a daring and courageous Avenger. So I think you know, the Scarlet Pimpernel, which appeared a good 14 or 15 years prior to Zorro, certainly had a pretty significant influence on the development of the Zorro character when Johnston McCulley developed him.
Yeah, I'd read that as well, by Emma Orczy, who did Scarlet Pimpernel, and that was first published in 1905.
Did I say 1905. I think in its first iteration, I think it may have been a stage play. I'm not certain about that.
They mentioned something about, I didn't know if that was the play was based, it just said like after her successful stage play. I wasn't sure if that was necessarily the same one or.
I think it might have been. Okay. And she eventually like sort of transformed it into the prose genre, and it became a novel in 1905. And
yes, that was in 1903. I think was the play.
Correct. Yeah. And what's I'm always kind of fascinated. I'm fascinated by a couple things. A, the fact that like her character was so influential on so many subsequent characters, especially in pulps and comics, not just Zorro, but also. Also, you have, you know, Clark Kent, Superman. You have, to some degree, you have Bruce Wayne, Batman. You could even make the, let's see, there's Peter Parker in the 60s. You could even make the case that maybe to some degree, Indiana Jones was somewhat influenced by the Scarlet Pimpernel in that he is sort of a, you know, sort of a soft-spoken and retiring archaeology professor by day, but then he has this other alter ego where he is this very much this adventurous explorer.
Right.
So, you know, the ripple effect of the Scarlet Pimpernel has went well into the 20th century and beyond. And what's always interesting about that to me is few people recognize her and her influence on not just the genre of pulps, but also, you know, I would say comics, film, etc. She's often forgotten in spite of the fact that she made such an enormous mark on that kind of character.
Yeah, it when you're talking about the double identity thing, that was the Clark Kent Superman was the first thing that kind of jumped out to me, that kind of like, you know, the mild-mannered reporter and then, you know, becomes the Man of Steel after that. And then Bruce Wayne to an extent as well, and a lot of iterations, you know, he has the billionaire playboy facade, you know, where he's kind of like, you know, often portrays himself as kind of like bumbling or unknowing or ignorant or all that.
Checked out.
Yeah. Also, I think you can make an argument for like Daredevil as well with the whole,
yes,
especially in the early issues when he really played up the blindness angle.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Sure.
Yeah. But yeah, that's something that has always been, and yeah, you're right. You know, basically, you know, the superhero genre was essentially invented by a woman. So that's really interesting, especially in light of all the Comicsgate stuff and that goes on now.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's a woman who is sort of forgotten in terms of her influence on the genre, which is, I think more recently she's gotten a little bit more of her due, but it seems like for decades, if not a century, it was, no one ever connected those dots.
Yeah. And yeah, you're right. It was it was the dime novels, what they were called. So it was kind of like
the
British equivalent of the pulps.
Right. And then certainly, you know, I know we're here to talk about one specific movie, but Zorro has been, I mean, he has been in more movies than I can count, frankly. At least 10 feature length films in the U.S. alone.
Yeah.
And then many more in not just in Europe and the UK, but also even like Turkey and India. He's certainly, you know, Zorro has made his mark all over the world.
Also a number of TV shows and animation. Oh yeah, as well.
Animated, yes, absolutely. And he's been in comics ever since the 1940s or 50s. I think he became very popular in the late 50s with the Disney television series that ran for, I think, 2 seasons, starring Guy Williams. And I think Dell Comics was running a Zorro series in tandem with that show. So he's been all over the big screen, small screen, live action, animation. I think there were actually there were a couple of if I'm not mistaken, there were some radio programs too.
Yes,
in the 1940s and or 1950s, I think. Yeah, a couple short-lived radio dramas and audio dramas produced in the U.S. and the U.K. Some as recently as 2011 in the U.K. Mm-hmm. As we said, animated television. I think there have been some announcements in the last couple of years of a couple live-action television series that are currently in development, including one from Disney ABC. But I don't know the status of those specifically. But I have read that there have been a couple announcements of some television, live action television projects.
Mm-hmm. There's also Dynamite's been doing a bunch of Zorro comics. Yes. They had Matt Wagner had did a 20 issue run. He had teamed up with like the Green Hornet and Kato and the Shadow and the Mask series. And what I think was probably the most interesting, and which is apparently being developed as a film, is Django Zorro, which was co-created co-written by Quentin Tarantino himself with Matt Wagner, and brought back it's a sequel to Django Unchained, brings back Django from that and has him team up with an aging Zorro, and they're working on developing a movie, and both Tarantino is not probably going to direct it, but he's going to produce it. But you know, Jamie Foxx wants to come back, and apparently they want Antonio Banderas to come back as Zorro.
Wow, he's not necessarily a young man anymore.
Well, I think that kind of works for the series, because the whole point of it was that Zorro's aging in the series.
Right. I remember Banderas doing an interview after the making of the sequel, the 2005 sequel, The Legend of Zorro. Mm-hmm. And I remember him saying, what I didn't realize was, you know, 8 years had passed since we made this last movie, and I'm 8 years older than I was before, and some of the stunt work is not as easy now as it was then, and it wasn't easy then. So he was very aware of the passage of time, you know, back when he made the sequel, which is a good 15 years ago. Close to 60 at this point, if I'm not mistaken, but I'm not sure about that.
I mean, he did The Expendables. Was it the third one he was in, I think? Was it the second one?
I think it was the third one.
He's still able to do some action stuff. So maybe he'd be able to do that if he's playing an older version of the character. It's funny you mentioned that, because one of the reasons they had changed the ending of Legend of Zorro, because the original ending had their son taking up the mantle, and it showed like an older Antonio Banderas and Catherine Zeta-Jones watching over him type of thing. And they had changed the ending because they thought they would get like another sequel out of that with Banderas coming back.
Well, yeah. I mean, I saw the sequel. I saw Legend of Zorro once. Mm-hmm. For as good as I thought the original, the Mask of Zorro was in 1998, I thought the sequel was pretty weak. And I'm not alone. A lot of the critics weren't too happy about it, and it didn't do well in the box office.
Yeah, I mean, it's got a pretty significant drop off in ratings, because the first one got like an 82 on Rotten Tomatoes, and the second one got like a 47 or something.
Not
often. I remember such a big drop off like that.
I remember seeing the sequel in a theater with my wife. It was our anniversary, so it must have been like fall of 2005. And we were both kind of excited to see it, because we both liked the first one, and we walked out of the theater and kind of looked at each other and kind of went meh. You know, it just didn't have it. It was a lot of the things that worked in the original movie did not work very well, if at all, in the second movie.
Yeah. 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 And it's odd, because you had, you know, basically the entire team coming back to that one.
Right. So. Minus Hopkins. Yeah, sure.
And it was so weird, because I remember back when that movie, when the first one came out, there was so much talk and everybody was asking, when are we going to get a sequel? When are we going to get a sequel? And then 8 years later, they finally give it to us and nobody really wants it.
Right. Well, it lacked a lot of the style. It's funny, because, you know, the chemistry between Banderas and Catherine Zeta-Jones was so good in the first movie, and it just didn't seem to be there in the second. And maybe they just weren't happy with the script. I don't know, but it just felt very flat all the way through.
Yeah. Yeah. So let's talk about this one then, The Mask of Zorro, 1998. Sure. I assume that you saw this in the theater.
I did. I saw it right when it came out. It was, I reviewed it actually for an alternative weekly newspaper I was working for at the time. It was one of the earlier movies that I ever reviewed. And I remember I did a lot of homework. I watched the 1920 silent version with Douglas Fairbanks. the Mark of Zorro. I went back and watched the 1940 version of the Mark of Zorro with Tyrone Power. I either before I saw the movie or right after, I actually found a paperback version of Johnston McCulley's original story, which was quite good actually. So I did my homework around this movie. So yeah, I did see it in the theater. It was a great experience. I didn't know what to expect. I wasn't really familiar with Banderas. I was to some degree, but not a whole lot. I had just seen Catherine Zeta-Jones 2 years earlier in the Phantom, which you and I discussed a couple months ago.
Right.
But I was excited about seeing the character on the big screen, and I was not disappointed.
Yeah, I don't think I saw this in the theater. I saw it sometime afterwards. I'm not sure if it was like, I think I'd seen it, rented it at one point, maybe like a year or two after that. And I remember really enjoying it at the time and then rediscovering it on DVD a few years later and, you know, one of the used DVDs sales or something and picking it up just with like a whole bunch of others and then rewatching it and be like, oh, wow, this is a lot better than I remembered. It's kind of like one of those movies that you kind of forget about. It doesn't like stick out in your mind. And then you rewatch it and you're like, how come, you know, more people don't talk about this movie?
Well, you know, there's, you know, I'm not going to lie. I think there are a couple things that don't work as well as they could, but for the most part, I think a lot of it they are far outweighed by the things that do work very well. I think, as I said, the chemistry between Banderas and Catherine Zeta-Jones is quite good. You know, Anthony Hopkins is Anthony Hopkins. I mean, he was still coming out. He was still riding high. He had done Silence of the Lambs, I think, in 91, which was a good 6 or 7 years prior, but still, I mean, that movie catapulted him to pretty much icon status. So anything he did after that, people were watching very closely, and he did a great job, I thought, as the older Zorro who passes the torch on to Banderas. And, you know, so it was, you know, that threesome was just a solid cast, and the supporting cast was also good. Mm-hmm. I would say enjoyable is an overused word when talking about movies, but I would call it that. You know, it has a few flaws here and there, but for the most part, it's just a very, very fun movie to watch.
Yeah. One of the things that, as I'm rewatching it, I was thinking, I'm like, oh, I know this director. And it's directed by Martin Campbell, who he not only did this, but he also, you know, kind of relaunched James Bond twice because he did GoldenEye in the mid 90s. And then when they rebooted the series with Daniel Craig, he directed Casino Royale.
Yes.
The best movies in both those eras of Bond, right? GoldenEye definitely best of the Brosnan ones, and and far and away, you know, Casino Royale was the best of the Craig era. And this was kind of like his first foray into superhero type media, which eventually got him the job of doing Green Lantern, which I know I'm gonna get hate mail for this, but I don't hate Green Lantern. I kind of enjoy it. I think it's fun.
I think I agree. I mean, I think I only saw it once. My takeaway was, well, that wasn't great, but it wasn't awful either. I'm kind of middle of the road on that movie. I don't think I hated it as much as some people did, but I wanted to like it more. I'll put it that way.
Yeah, I mean, I'm also not a really big Green Lantern fan, so you know, take that with as much of a grain of salt as you need.
Sure. Yeah. You mentioned the two Bond films. Just today, I read, I'm not sure, I was doing some homework about this in preparation for this discussion, and I read somewhere that Martin Campbell, he was offered the opportunity to direct subsequent Bond films after GoldenEye, but he basically said, I think this character is getting stale. I think this franchise is getting stale. If you come up with a better actor, I may reconsider it. And I don't think GoldenEye was Brosnan's last Bond movie, was it?
No, that was his first.
It was his first. Okay, so, but sure enough, he got offered Casino Royale with Daniel Craig, and he took it because he liked the idea of Daniel Craig, and he liked the story, and he liked the idea that they were sort of, you know, revitalizing the whole. The whole Bond franchise. I kind of agree with him. I saw some of those last movies before Craig, and I thought, God, I feel like I've seen this movie over and over again.
Yeah, it got into a sameness. Although I thought Brosnan, I would definitely take Brosnan over Craig though.
Really?
Okay. Yeah, just like Craig, he I was watching No Time to Die, you know, a few weeks ago, and it's just, I don't know, like, aside from Skyfall, his and Casino Royale, most of his Bond movies, they didn't really do much for me. I think, like, his take on the character was just kind of very dour, and it just wasn't very appealing.
Yeah, I agree. And here's the part where I might get crucified or hate mail, but I'm not a huge Bond fan. I mean, okay. I've seen several. I would say I've seen most of the movies, but I haven't seen all of them. So I can't say I've done the deep dive into James Bond 007. But where was I going with that? But I don't dislike Brosnan, but I thought Craig coming out of the gate was strong.
He was really strong in that first movie, yeah. But it
right, like, I think he got tired pretty quick. I think
very quickly.
And I think he said so publicly. He basically, I think there were a couple public announcements. He basically said, "I'm getting tired of doing this guy, and it's time for me to step away."
Yeah.
So I mean, you know, every Bond actor has had his place. You know, I think I like Craig more than you did, but I see your point. I mean, they're a very different take on the character.
Yeah, yeah. But and tying it back to this, one of the things that I thought was really cool that this movie did is, I think this may be, because I know they had done this in previous Zorro films, but I think in the modern era, at least, this was probably the first time we really see like a legacy character in a superhero movie. Where we see like that passing of the torch, because that's a thing in you know, superhero lore. Like, you know, you get the, you know, different characters have been the Flash, different characters have been Green Lantern, Batman, Captain America, and so on and so forth. But in superhero movies, at least, you didn't really see that often. Like, it was always the main guy, and you don't really see a whole passing of the torch. You don't see that legacy aspect. Until probably, yeah. I don't think we really get to that until I want to say maybe Falcon and Winter Soldier. I mean, I'm sure I'm forgetting something, but I'm trying to think and I can't really remember anything.
Well, you raise an interesting point about the whole genre. I mean, if you really step back and look at it, and this is going to sound almost Jungian, but in almost every instance in this genre, in the superhero genre, the hero does not truly become the hero until the father or the father figure dies.
Oh yeah,
which I think speaks somewhat to what you're talking about, the idea of the backstory, the events leading up to the creation, the genesis of this hero. But I'm trying to think to your question: have we seen anything like that? Had we seen anything like that before this movie? And I off the top of my head, I can't think of anything. We were talking about the Phantom a couple months ago, and you know, there's mention of, you know, the prior Phantom. He has those conversations with
the spirit
of his father, but that's almost sort of incidental to the story. Whereas in this movie, it's pivotal. It's integral to the story.
Yeah. And I don't think we really, and like I said, I don't think we really see it again until Falcon and Winter Soldier. There's not really a whole lot of instances, unless you count if you're talking animation, then we see it in Batman Beyond. But other than that, it hasn't really been done a whole lot in, at least in live action.
Yeah, passing of the torch. I'm just trying to think of where we may have seen that in this, and I can't off the top of my head. I'm sure I'll think of something after we stop talking. But I think you're right. I think this is one of the first times, if not the first time, we actually dig deep into that concept.
And it's an interesting concept because they had done this apparently a few times in the movies. I'm not sure. Did they ever do that in the books? Do you know?
There's certainly, I mean, in prior movies and in the books, there certainly are mentions of Zorro's father. You see him in the Tyrone Power version in 1940. I don't recall. It's been a long time since I've seen the 1920 silent version with Douglas Fairbanks. Even in some of the serials, there were a number of serials, Zorro serials that were made in the 1930s and 40s. And I think there's a couple, let me see. I made some notes here. Serial. There was one in 1947 called The Son of Zorro. George Turner plays a Civil War era descendant of Zorro. The Ghost of Zorro, another serial in 1949. Clayton Moore, also known as the Lone Ranger, plays Zorro's grandson. So you have those instances, but those are serials. Those are lesser known, but I guess, you know, if you're gonna really look closely, I guess you could say that those are instances where we see Zorro as the descendant of a prior Zorro.
And it's usually a descendant. This time they bring in someone completely different, and I didn't realize this until after I was watching the movie and I did some research. The character that Banderas plays, Alejandro Murrieta, he's the fictional brother, because his brother Joaquin gets killed in the, well, shoots himself when he gets captured in the movie. And that's a real historical figure. He was kind of like he was like a Robin Hood type of character.
I did some research about that too, and I had no idea, and I've seen this movie four or five times, and I had no idea that there was actually like a sort of a historical underpinning to those characters. I mean, you know, not just him, but also the character of Harrison Love, because the real life Murrieta, who, you know, a lot of the details of his life are very sketchy. It's a lot more legend, I think, than real. But I mean, but as I understand it,
Three Finger Jack as well was a real person, although he wasn't American. He was Mexican, I believe.
Yes, and Harry Love, he was the leader, the real life Harry Love. He was the leader of a group of California Rangers who were assigned the task of tracking down a group of Mexican bandits known as the Five Joaquins. And one of these Five Joaquins was allegedly Joaquin Murrieta. And in 1853, the Rangers encountered a band of Mexicans and killed three of them. And as proof of the killing, the Rangers cut off the alleged head of Murrieta and the alleged hand of Three Fingers Jack, and stored him in a jar of alcohol, and brought them back to the authorities to collect the bounty. So midway through the movie, when you see the Harrison Love character played by Matthew Letcher, when you see him pull the big jar of alcohol out of his cabinet and confront Alejandro with this severed head, there's sort of a historical connection to that most viewers, I didn't know until this afternoon. I was doing some research.
Yeah, and apparently Murrieta is believed to have been the inspiration of Zorro.
Yes, correct.
So it's interesting how they brought those back together.
But in this movie, he's the brother.
I like the way that they linked that, and they kind of worked in the historical parallels there.
Yeah, I had no idea about any of that until about 5 hours ago when I was doing some research.
Yeah. Anthony Hopkins. It's really funny watching him in this, and I know there's obviously an argument to be made that, you know, you're casting a Welsh guy to play a Spaniard here,
and a Welsh woman to play his
daughter, and then you cast a Spaniard to play a Mexican character.
Right.
They're definitely, those are good points to make. Although one of the things I thought was funny is that, you know, nobody knows that Diego is Zorro in, you know, his time during his time as the character, even though, you know, Anthony Hopkins is probably the only guy walking around speaking with a Welsh accent.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. But he's Anthony Hopkins, right?
He's Anthony Hopkins, yeah.
Right. Yeah, like I said, he was, you know, I don't want to say he was just coming off of Silence of the Lambs, but he certainly, he was still riding high from the success of that movie and that, you know, the Hannibal Lecter character. And I think for a good decade or so after he made that movie, the guy could do no wrong.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, it's funny because I recently learned that actually he was not the original choice for that role. My understanding was the producers were looking at they're looking at both Raul Julia and Sean Connery.
Sean Connery.
Raul
Julia would have been perfect. Yeah.
Well, he would have, but he died.
Yeah.
Sean Connery. I like Sean Connery a lot in most of what he's done. But I'm kind of glad that he didn't get this role because it would have become a Sean Connery movie.
It also would have been echoes of his role in Highlander.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. I mean, it just, you know, I love the Untouchables, but the truth of the matter is it's a movie about Elliot Ness and Al Capone, but it's a Sean Connery movie. And Sean Connery's presence in that movie and in many of his movies kind of overshadows everyone around him.
Yeah.
And I think it would have been a disservice to both Banderas, the actor, and Zorro, the character, to put Sean Connery in that role in that movie.
Yeah. Although it is, you know, we mentioned that Raul Julia had died before he could take this role. And that is a real shame, because this role would have been perfect for him.
Oh yeah, I think so. Mm-hmm. He died suddenly, if I'm not mistaken. I think it was a heart attack or something like that.
He'd been sick for a while leading up to it, because Street Fighter was his last movie, and he was really kind of like, his illness was really kind of exhibiting itself. I think it was cancer, if I'm not mistaken.
Okay.
It may have been a heart attack that finally did him in, but I do know that he had had cancer or something like that for a while before he died.
Not an old man by any means.
No, not
late 40s.
Something like that. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. That would have been interesting. Yeah. To get another Latin actor in there.
Yeah. But you make a good point about Anthony Hopkins, because, you know, after Silence of the Lambs, anytime you had like an older type of character, mentor type of character or something like that, he was always like the one who was considered. He was even being considered for Jor-El when they were planning to do Superman Lives at one point. And then eventually, you know, obviously they get him to play Odin in the Thor movies.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, he's sort of made for that kind of role. The mentor, father, you know, the sort of the wise sage, you know, mentor type. Yeah.
Yeah. But he did a, you know, accent aside, I thought he did a really good job in this movie. And he really plays up those different aspects of the character. He really blends those different versions, those different things that the character is going through. So like the anger, the longing for his daughter, but even mixed with that, like the charm he's got as Zorro, all of that works really well.
Oh yeah. I was thinking about this earlier today. I mean, he, you know, if you put yourself in that character's shoes, I mean, he's dealing with, you know, an amazing level of rage. You know, he watches his wife get murdered before his eyes. He watches his infant daughter be taken away from him, and he winds up in a prison for 20 years. So, you know, here's this character with this incredible amount of rage. And yet there's this very, I was struck by this very tender moment. He's in a stable, he's grooming a horse, and in walks Catherine Zeta-Jones. And he's trying very hard to have a conversation with her without just, you know, screaming out the fact that, you know, I am your real father, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And it's just, you can feel the tension and the sadness in him. Like, you know, I can't believe I'm here talking to my daughter, who I haven't seen in 20 years since she was a tiny, tiny baby. Mm. And as she, you know, she says goodbye and walks away, he's practically in tears. It's just, you know, the guy's acting chops are, you know, top notch. And in a role like that, it just, he does very well.
That scene really, and maybe it's because, you know, I hadn't seen this movie since I became a father, and, you know, rewatching it now. And like, I felt for that scene a lot more than I ever had before. And I think that's a big part of that. Like there are certain movies that I remember talking about this when we were talking about the Amazing Spider-Man movies and the death scene with Captain Stacy, and how, you know, you watch it before you're a father, and that scene rings really differently to you compared to after you become a father. And I think this movie does the same thing. There are certain movies that after you've gone through that experience, you look at them in a very different light.
Oh, anytime I see a film where children are being abducted, I never liked seeing that stuff. But once I became a dad, it was even harder to watch that.
Yeah.
Stuff. There are instances where I can't even watch that stuff. I'm thinking of, not to get off track, but Mystic River, where Sean Penn's daughter winds up getting killed.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And they find her at the bottom of a ravine. I think she's like 14 or 15 years old. Mm-hmm. And there's this moment where you know, the police are down there huddled around this body, and he's on the other side of the street, and he realizes what's going on, and like his friends are holding him back, and he's running into the street. I remember watching it, and I was watching with my wife, and our daughter was very young at the time, and she just turned to me, she said, "You want me to turn it off?" I said, "No, keep going, it's good." But I know that feeling very much. So it just it's harder once you become a father. It really
is. Yeah. And Antonio Banderas, like, again, you know, ethnicity issues aside in the casting, I'm hard pressed to think of someone who would be a better fit for the character of Zorro, because
I remember when it was announced, I thought the same thing. I thought, well, that sounds perfect. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Cause he's got, it's funny. The one scene that kind of jumps out to me is, well, the thing about Banderas is he's actually a really funny actor too.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
I think a lot of people kind of like overlook that when they're thinking about it. Cause he's very charming. He's, you know, he can be very dramatic, but he's also really good at the comedy aspect too. Like
absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
The first part where he's playing the kind of like foppish Alejandro before he gets the training. It's just a lot of fun to watch.
Well, it just, yeah. And you mentioned the word foppish, and he does a little bit of that in this movie, not as much as Tyrone Power did in 1940. I mean, Tyrone Power basically raised that foppish aspect to an art form. I still feel like that version has a little bit of an edge over this one, because Tyrone Power, you know, handled that role in some subtle ways that just were so good. But you're right. No, Banderas is, you know, and in some of the movies he's done since, both live action and animated, you really do realize that you're right. I mean, he's a very good comedic actor in addition to being a very good dramatic actor.
Yeah.
So I mean, I think one of the best, probably the funniest line in the film, and probably the funniest line in a lot of films I've seen. And I'm sure you remember the scene where, you know, basically Hopkins tells him, "Okay, we're gonna make you the new Zorro," and he's all excited about this because he wants to exact revenge from Harrison Love. And you know, he grabs a sword and he starts waving it around, and he's yahooing, and Hopkins says, "Do you have any idea how to use that thing?" Mm-hmm. And Banderas says, "Yeah, the pointy end goes in the other man." It's one of the funniest. It's clearly to me the funniest line in the movie, and the funniest line in a lot of movies I've ever seen. But that one always stands out for me.
Well, also along with that is, you know, he's showing off all his sword moves when he's supposed to be facing off with Zorro for the training, and then just Anthony Hopkins just takes one swipe and knocks it completely out of his hand. It
flies across the room. Yeah, yeah, it's great.
But one of the funniest parts for me is when he tells Alejandro, he's like, you know, "We're gonna have to teach you how to become a gentleman." And the very next scene, all that training is done, because it's hard to imagine like Antonio Banderas having to go through a whole lot of training for that.
To be charming, right?
He's almost too good for the character at that point in the movie.
Yeah. And I thought of that myself. I thought, you know, this guy, you know, when you first see him as an adult, when you first see Alejandro as an adult, it's, you know, it's this hairy, grizzly version of Antonio Banderas. And he's, you know, he's being dragged through the dust in the desert, and he's, you know, he's a bandit. He's a thief, and he's beyond rough around the edges. And in a matter of maybe like, you know, 30 or 40 minutes of film, maybe not quite that much, I don't know, but you know, he's this very charming. He shows up at the bank. He basically crashes the party. He shows up at the banquet of Don Montero, and he's just so smooth. He's just a smooth customer. And you're right. It's just sort of like how did he pull that off in a short time like that? But then again, he's Banderas, so yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Especially the dancing, and I'm like I don't think that Antonio that Zorro taught him how to do that part,
because it just seems to come out of nowhere.
Because even Anthony Hopkins got to look surprised when he sees it.
Yeah, he does that double take from the balcony. Like, wait, that's him. But it's funny because the dance scene is one of a couple different Zorro motifs that keeps showing up in different film versions of this character. There's a very well choreographed dance scene in the Tyrone Power version. I think there's a dance scene in the Douglas Fairbanks version. I'm not sure. There's also there's a scene where Banderas does a quick sleight of hand trick, and he pulls a rose out of his sleeve and hands it to Catherine Zeta-Jones. Mm-hmm. He does similar sleight of hand magic in the 1940 version. He does similar sleight of hand magic in the 1920 version. So there's these little touchstones that the filmmakers keep coming back to. Like, yeah, Zorro does magic. Zorro's a good dancer. Mm-hmm. There was another one. There's a sword fight in this movie where, and I don't remember who it's between, but one of the rapiers it slices some candles, and you see a very similar scene like that in the Tyrone Power version. It's just again, it's another callback to, you know, an earlier version of this story from what, 80 years ago. Mm-hmm. So yeah.
Yeah, and And I think, I'm not sure, because you said that Tyrone Power had, and, you know, had played it, you know, played up the foppish angle. And one of the things I thought, you know, and after you hearing you say that, and then, you know, thinking about that banquet scene, and I'm not sure if this is actually intentional or not, but I got a lot of Bruce Wayne vibes from the way he plays like the gentleman type of character.
Yes, yes, I agree. I agree. So
I wonder if there was a lot of influence from, you know, the more successive Zorro successors, so to speak.
Well, in the Tyrone Power version, he really, like, there's a moment in that version where he shows up from Spain and he is told by somebody, I can't remember who, that basically, you know, here's the situation. Your father's been sort of ousted from power and these corrupt, you know, these corrupt men have sort of taken over. Mm-hmm. And the camera goes tight on Power's face. And you can see it's fascinating to watch. And I recommend it if you haven't seen it. He does this thing where, with his face, where you can see the whole plan falling into place behind his eyes in a matter of, I'm going to say, 3, maybe 4 seconds. And from that moment on, he is this sort of like foppish, waving his hanky around, talking about, flower. It just from that moment on, he is instantly this sort of, you know, shy, retiring, like, I don't want to get my hands dirty. Oh, this dreadful Zorro character. What's he all about? Even to the point where his own father is like, who are you? You're not my son. I didn't raise you like this. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and he's so good at it for the entire movie that he fools everyone, almost to the point where he's fooling you, the viewer, because he's mm-hmm. These characters are so dichotomous and they're played by the same person. Mm-hmm. If you haven't seen it, I recommend it because I think, you know, Banderas does a little bit of it in this film, but I think Power really takes it to a next level throughout the entire story.
Yeah, I think, I think it's hard too for Banderas to kind of turn off the charm in that kind of situation.
Right, exactly,
as well.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But I there was a little hint of that. I think it was, and that was probably a callback to the Tyrone Power stuff when, you know, he's saying that, you know, all this, you know, running around and jumping on horses gives me a headache.
Right. Right, exactly. He says something about, I think he refers to him as a dreadful character or something like that. But right. Call back to that. It wasn't as extreme as Power did it, but certainly a sort of a nod to that, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And Catherine Zeta-Jones, like we talked about her in, as you mentioned, The Phantom. Mm-hmm. And this was like her second really kind of big role in,
I think this was her breakout. I think this was the one that, this was the movie that really put her on the map, I think.
I think so too, yeah. I didn't remember hear much of her before this movie, and then after this movie, she was like everywhere.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, for whatever reason, I mean, you know, we talked at length about The Phantom. It was a different kind of movie, but this movie had broader appeal, so a lot more people saw this movie, a lot more people saw her in this movie, and what's interesting, I assumed, because she did the accent very well, I assumed she was Spanish, and apparently a lot of people did, because I saw her do an interview a few years later, and she joked about that. She said after I did Zorro, Hollywood just assumed I was Spanish, and I'm not. I'm Welsh, and I thought that was funny because I kind of did myself, and she obviously was not, and. But she pulled it off. I mean, she had this, you know, she did the accent very well, and she looked, you know, she looked like she could have been. It just, you know, the way she dressed, the way her hair was done, it just, I think she fooled a lot of people.
She did. Yeah. I definitely remember being surprised when I heard her, when I saw her in another movie and she was speaking with a Spanish, in the British accent. And my first thought was, why is she doing a British accent for this part?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But yeah, apparently there are other, apparently Isabel Scorupco, who's in previously mentioned GoldenEye, she had screen tested for this. Also, Salma Hayek, Jennifer Lopez, and even Shakira also screen tested for the role.
Wow. Okay.
So
Shakira was not well known in 1990.
No, I was going to say like that. Yeah. I don't think I really heard of her until, you know, probably about like early 2000s.
Mm. You know, the one thing about this movie that strikes me occasionally, and I say occasionally, and I mean it, it's not very often, but there are moments in this film that are it suffers a little bit from the same dynamic that we talked about relative to the Phantom, in that it occasionally you know, I don't know if it's Martin Campbell, I don't know if it's the, you know, if it's the screenwriters, but occasionally it's not sure whether it's a dramatic film or a comedic film.
I think there's more of that in the Phantom, although yes, I definitely
by far
yeah there is a little bit of that in here, I think. Yeah, I yes. think you're definitely right.
Yeah, not much. There are a few instances where, like, you know, again, I think of the scene where Harrison Love confronts Murrieta with the severed head of his brother. Mm-hmm. I mean, that to me is like that is a pivotal moment in the story, and that's like that is the most memorable. I mean, that's when you realize this, you know, this is not just a villain. This is a sociopath.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's a pretty dark place to go in a film that is also peppered with moments of comedy as well. Mm-hmm. And it just, it happens occasionally, not as much as it did in The Phantom, but it does happen occasionally, but not enough to mar the film in any way.
I think the most it happens is more in the first half of the film. Yes. Like the scenes when, you know, when Murrieta is going out as kind of like the proto Zorro, I think
trying to figure out what does it mean to be Zorro. Yeah, I'm going to steal a horse now. Yeah, right, exactly. Yeah, I agree.
That's when it really kind of gets. I found myself kind of like drifting to my phone during those scenes because they were fun, but it was just kind of like it didn't fit with the tone of the rest of the movie. It felt a little.
I think that's what I'm trying to say. It's there are certain moments, especially in that first half of the film, where it's almost like. It's not doing justice to the character. It's a little bit too mocking of the character, mm-hmm. but not too much, but a little more than it needs to be.
Yeah. Once we get past the training, I think from the banquet on, the movie really finds its footing. I think that's the pivotal part of the movie. And that's when it really kind of like settles into what it's going to be. And from then on, it's just gravy all the way through to the end.
And I think when Montero takes all the other Dons, including Murrieta, out mm-hmm. to the mine to see what he's up to.
Right.
And that's when Murrieta has this moment where like it's no longer just about me and my personal vendetta. This is an evil human being who's doing evil things to other innocent human beings. That's that to me is the moment when he's no longer just a figure of vengeance. Now he's a figure of justice,
which,
you know, he makes this realization. You can almost see it in his face where it's like, I can't believe what I'm seeing here. This, you know, he's made slaves of these people to mine his gold, and he's dehumanized them to the point where like, he's just going to dispense with them when he's done. That to me is a really important moment in the story. I agree. It's the second half really is much stronger.
Yeah. You mentioned about Tyrone Power and how you saw in his face how like the entire plan comes together. Mm-hmm. And when you said that, my first thought was that scene, because you do kind of see that in Banderas's, not so much, you know, a plan coming together, but just like that kind of like change when, like you said perfectly, he goes from being a figure of vengeance to a figure of justice.
Right. Right. Which to me is this just like, you know, those are the best moments of stories like this, of the superhero genre, when the character realizes this isn't just about me. It's still about me, but it's also about something much greater than me. That's mm-hmm. that's the great moment for me.
Yeah. Now Stuart Wilson, who plays Montero, apparently originally Armand Asante had been cast in the role but had scheduling conflicts. Yes. Mm-hmm. But I don't, you know what, the entire time I was watching him is I kept thinking, like, it feels like they want him to be Alan Rickman.
You know, because there's certainly the look, the voice. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I hadn't thought of that, but yeah, I see your point. There's something very Alan Rickman about him, a la, like, you know, in the same vein as what he played Sheriff of Nottingham. Rickman played Sheriff of Nottingham in Prince of Thieves. Right, sure.
That's exactly what I was thinking of. When he first appeared on screen, I'm like, wait a minute, is that Alan Rickman? it's like he's like trying to do an Alan Rickman in Prince of Thieves in a way. Although Alan Rickman was much more theatrical and over the top, and that kind of pulled me out whenever Montero was on screen, because I just kept thinking, I'm like, man, imagine if Alan Rickman had played this part.
Well, you know, but I guess I go to the same place I go to when I said what I said about Sean Connery. If you had put Alan Rickman in that role, it may have become too much about Alan Rickman and not about the character anymore.
Yeah, that's because, a good point.
Yeah. You know, there's a funny, I don't want to say funny, it's not a fair word, but there's a scene, I'm sure you remember it, when the older Zorro, Hopkins, he basically burns an enormous Z in the hillside.
Mm-hmm.
And it's basically, it's a message to Montero, like, you know, Zorro's back, you better get ready, you better deal with it, because you know, Zorro's coming for you. In whatever guise, whether it's me or my young protege, Zorro is coming for you. And Harrison Love goes to the window and he sees this. I think they both see it through the window, and suddenly Montero's all agitated.
Mm-hmm.
And Harrison Love says, I don't understand what you're so concerned about. It's just, he's just one man. And Montero says, he's not just one man, damn it, he's Zorro. And it's funny because, I mean, that could be perceived as a very cheesy line of dialogue, but for the 12-year-old me watching that film, of course I was like in my 30s when I saw it for the first time, but like a line like that always pushes my buttons, because it's like, it's this recognition that, you know, the villain realizes, I'm not dealing with just a person. I'm dealing with an idea. I'm dealing with like something bigger than a person. This is again, you know, the difference between vengeance and justice. It's just like, he's basically saying, this person is a representative of all people, and I'm not dealing with just this guy. I'm dealing with the will of an entire group of people now, and I have to fight that battle, not just one guy with a hat and a black cape and a sword.
Mm-hmm. Something else that this movie I think did really well, and it did something kind of similar to what Raiders of the Lost Ark did, where Raiders of the Lost Ark was kind of like this love letter to the adventure serials. Yeah. Whereas this was kind of like a love letter to the swashbuckling pictures, like the 1940s. Sure. And mentioning Alan Rickman in Prince of Thieves is an interesting comparison to look at that movie, because Alan Rickman is like the only actor in that movie who thought he was doing an homage to the swashbuckling pictures, whereas everybody else is playing it very dour and serious.
Right.
This movie, you know, it's the opposite of that, right? Everybody knows what they're doing. And kind of like we were talking about with The Phantom, where you've got, you know, Billy Zane and Catherine Zeta-Jones trying to play it mostly like a serious movie. And then you've got Treat Williams and, you know, Christy Swanson playing it as if they're in a parody.
This movie,
you don't really have any of that problem. Like it's solid all the way through. It's very much that homage. It very much captures that feel of those old swashbuckling movies.
Yeah, I mean, and I'm thinking of some of those old movies. Certainly there was Captain Blood with Errol Flynn, Adventures of Robin Hood with Errol Flynn, both in the 1930s. I would count the 1940s version of Zorro among the swashbuckler movies. Mm-hmm. I've seen a lot of those. I'm familiar with a lot of those. And I think you're right. I think they were kind of going for that. I mean, you could almost see, if Errol Flynn were alive today and young and healthy and, you know, in good shape, you could see him in this role easily. Mm-hmm. I mean, why not have a Tasmanian in the role, because you've already got, you know, a bunch of Englishmen. So, you know, why not? But
and that brings up another point, is the action in this movie. I mean, it's Martin Campbell. So he knows how to direct an action scene, and it's done really well. But the standout for me is the scene when, Zorro faces off against Love, and he pulls out the sword and the sun glints off it.
Yeah. Fantastic effect.
And it's that's not CGI or anything. That was all natural. So like Banderas, that was Banderas's idea. Actually, he wanted to have the sun glinting off the sword. So they had to do it took them like three takes to get it just right.
God, only three. I would figured, you know, to stage that properly in natural sunlight, that would take I would think that would take like 15 or 20.
Only three takes.
If he did it in three, good for them. Yeah, that's fantastic. Cause it was great effect. I remember the first time I saw it in a theater, I thought, wow, that's cool. I mean, it's a small momentary split second thing, but you don't miss it. It's right there. And you know, bigger than life. You don't miss that. And it's just a perfect visual touch. Yeah. I really like that whole face off. What I liked you know, the thing that Campbell did really well, I thought, was you basically had these two heroes confronting their nemesis at literally the same time.
Yes.
Probably within like 100 yards of each other, each fighting their own war for their own reasons. But like it's sort of in parallel, but also like, you know, it's all intersecting in this one place, in this one time, in this one moment. And yeah, it's like, there are so many, like, I want to say false endings to that battle. Just when you think, you know, you know, the hero has the villain licked. There's always some trick that they have up their sleeve. You know, I think it happens like 3 or 4 times in each case. It draws out the action, and it draws out the suspense, but it's done well.
One of the parts that really jumped out at me is when Diego is fighting with Montero, and he shouts to Elena to get the people out. And it's just this one small line. It's like a blink and you miss it type of thing, but it says so much about his character in that moment that I realize on retrospect, because earlier there's that whole talk about, you know, well, are they fighting for justice or are they just fighting for revenge? And Diego proves in that moment that he's still fighting for justice too, because he's concerned about the other people. And I thought that was a really nice touch.
And I think that is the coda to the moment we were talking about earlier. When he and the other Dons are visiting the mine, and he has that epiphany, like, wow, this is just like, this is insanity, you know, in real time. And I think his, like you say, his turning to Elena and saying, get the people.
Well, that was Diego who says that to Elena. Murray, not Alejandro.
You're right. Okay. You're right. Okay. Well, yeah.
But it is a coda to another thing though, because there was that earlier conversation because Alejandro asks Diego, like, what about the people and all that when they're in the Zorro cave, you know, for lack of a better term.
Right. Right.
And
not
Diego's,
my problem, basically.
Yeah. He seems to be more caring about, you know, getting revenge and getting his daughter back. And that moment when he tells Elena to get the people out, that's kind of like the moment when that's the coda to that scene.
Right. You know, it's funny because maybe I didn't know it when I first saw the movie 23-24 years ago. But it seems like that has become a more common, I guess the word is motif, plot twist. One of the two heroes just backs away. Says, this is not my deal. I'm done. I'm out. I can't, I've done everything I can do. I can't commit to any more of this. This is too much for me, et cetera. And they bolt. But in the third act, guess who shows up when the chips are really down? It's that one heroic character who thought they wanted to walk out on the whole situation, but realized they couldn't.
Right, like the Han Solo moment.
Right, exactly. Yeah, and it just, I've become more aware of that storytelling style than I had been, say, 30 years ago. But I think this movie is a really good example of that, you know, for the reasons you just said. Don Diego is basically, he's like, you know, I'm just here to get my daughter and get my life back.
Yeah.
And I'm done. I'm out. And which is really, I mean, it is. I mean, and Alejandro's response to that is this sort of like disbelief, like shock. Mm-hmm. Like, I can't believe you've brought me this far and now you're going to walk away.
Yeah.
And you, the viewer, kind of go there with him, because it is kind of surprising to hear Don Diego say that, because he was the one who's so committed to making sure that, you know, that all the scales are balanced.
Right.
So it's almost like, you know, the thief and the bandit becomes the real hero, and the guy you thought who was the real hero is basically ready to bail at a moment's notice.
Yeah. Something else too that jumped out at me rewatching this movie is the way that Diego reacts when he sees Alejandro and Elena together. Because in a lesser movie, I think they would have played up the whole, you know, overprotective father angle, where it's like, you know, you're even though you're Zorro, you're a bandit, and, you know, stay away from my daughter type of thing. But you never get any of that in this movie.
You don't.
Because, you know, you see him, like, at first when he looks kind of surprised to see them dancing, but then he smiles.
I was gonna say happily surprised. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's like I said, I said this before, he's up on the balcony. You know, he's posing as the footman, and he looks over the balcony at the dancing going on the floor below him. And it's like a double take that he does. And you're right. You almost expect him to just sort of roll his eyes. Like, what the hell is he doing with my daughter? Mm-hmm. He's here on a mission, a fact finding mission. And he's dancing with my daughter. But you're right. He smiles. And it's almost like he knows intuitively, of course, this is, you know, I have this high spirited daughter and I've taken on this very high spirited protege. Mm-hmm. It just stands to reason that they would wind up together, because that they're sort of like, you know, two sides of the same coin.
Yeah. And I like that the movie avoided that kind of cliche.
Yes.
You know, the you're not good enough for my daughter type of thing. Because that's a trope that, you know, gets really old. So I'm really glad mm-hmm. that they avoided that.
Mm-hmm. Or the you're not good enough for my daughter until you prove to me otherwise.
Right.
Captain Stacy in the Spider-Man film.
Well, I thought Captain Stacy, I thought it was a different thing, because on the surface you might think that, but there are a few scenes where they give a little more context to him, and like mm-hmm. you know, he walks in on Peter and Gwen in the room, but he doesn't say anything, right?
Right, right.
He
right,
just kind of
right.
like kind of like looks at Gwen. He's like, hey, you know, I'm trusting you, right? It's just kind of like, and then later when Peter comes to him all panicked about Kirk Connors, and you know, Stacy kind of shoos him away. But then after that, he turns to the other guy and he says, "Get me everything you have on Kirk Connors."
Right, 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 right. I don't want to admit that I trust this kid, but I trust this kid.
Right. Yeah. There are these little scenes that add a little bit more context to that relationship.
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
So I thought that was really well done in that movie. And you know, you can go back and listen to when Kellen Conley and I talked about Amazing Spider-Man, because we specifically talked about those scenes. But that got me thinking again about this movie. Those scenes took me back to that movie, because again, they had kind of sidestepped that typical cliche of you're not good enough for my daughter or anything like that.
Right, right. It would have been too easy and too predictable.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah,
yeah. Anything else you want to mention about this movie?
You know, like I said at the outset, you know, it's a, you know, like any movie, there are very few movies that have no flaws, if any, but right. You know, the good far outweighs the bad in this film. You know, it's funny because the director, you know, Martin Campbell, his resume is all over the place. If you look back, mm-hmm. I mean, it goes back to the mid-70s. He started out doing like British sex comedies and then he took like a 12-year break, and then he was doing legal thrillers for a while. He did a sci-fi film in 1994. Then he did the Bond movies. He's done a number of action thrillers. His resume is kind of diverse and a little uneven, but yet none of that is problematic here. I mean, he mm-hmm. clearly seems to know what he's doing in this particular film, at least, you know, and like we said earlier, that, you know, there are the occasional comedic moments that to me don't always ring as true as they could, or maybe they're unnecessary, but the good far outweighs the bad here. And I think the movie really does justice to the character and the legacy of the character. And, you know, I think it stands up well with, you know, the other classic films about this character. It's a different take from Tyrone Power, but it's an excellent take, and it's a story well told. I own it on disc. I've watched it at least four or five times now, including just two nights ago. You know, it's a good movie, to keep going back to every few years.
Yeah, I agree. And talking about Martin Campbell, whenever I rewatch this or GoldenEye or Casino Royale, to a lesser extent as well, Legend of Zorro and Green Lantern, I do think, you know, I wish we'd get to see a little bit more work from him. I wish he got, you know, a bit more of his due, because I think he does deserve a lot more credit than he actually gets. Because I mean, these are, you know, two franchises that he basically kind of, you know, resurrected. You know,
yeah,
sure. One of them he had resurrected twice.
Right, right, right. Yeah, with two different actors. Right.
Yeah, yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
And two very different takes, right? Because GoldenEye was very much like the classic Bond take, but modernized.
Yes.
Whereas
yes.
Casino Royale was, you know, kind of like eschewing the classic elements and kind of a very darker take on. And he excelled yes. in both of them. So I really think those two exactly. movies. And then you see something like this, where it's like this callback to the swashbuckling pictures, and it shows, like, you know, how much range he has in these three very different action movies.
Mm-hmm. Right. And it just, and again, I think it speaks to the diversity of his resume. You know, he's done, he's been making movies for about 50 years, maybe not as many movies as some other directors might make in 50 years, but what he has made is diverse. I mean, it's, again, it's legal thrillers. It's action movies. It's, there was a romance in there. What was it? Beyond Borders 2003 with Angelina Jolie and Clive Owen, a romantic drama. Which almost doesn't fit with the rest of his resume, but you know, he's demonstrated over the years that he can do a lot of different kinds of things and usually do them well, with a couple exceptions. But yeah, it just, you're right. It would be, or would have been, or would be nice to see more from him.
Yeah. So now, my understanding of talking about the character of Zorro in general, and you might know about this more than me, because I was trying to do a little bit of research and I just got kind of confused. Do you know what the legal status is with this character? Is he actually copyrighted or no?
That's a good question. I know of a number of small press publishers who are doing stuff with the character. I know that, like I said, Moonstone is publishing some stories, and there's another publisher based in Florida whose name I can't, it's run by a woman named Audrey Parente and a guy named Rich Harvey. And I can't I can't think of the name of their shop, but they have been reprinting some of the original Johnston McCulley stories. I don't know what the copyright status is on this character. I don't know if he's public domain. I tend to think he's not public domain, but I don't know for sure.
Yeah, because
I couldn't tell you.
Trying to read through it, because I know there's the Zorro estate and all that, but it struck me, I saw a lot of similarities between that and like the Sherlock Holmes thing, where the estate keeps trying to claim copyright, even though the courts have been like, no, you don't own this.
Right.
But I'm not sure if it's the same thing with Zorro or not.
I don't know. I don't know what, if any, descendants Johnston McCulley has.
I don't know, but he had sold the copyright to someone else.
Is that right?
I was reading that last night. Yeah. And then that guy's descendants now are running the Zorro estate.
I see. Because McCulley wrote several Zorro stories after that first one in 1919. I think he was writing Zorro stories into the 1950s. So that's like 30 years plus. So he had a lot of Zorro output with his own name on it before other writers started to pick up the torch. But I don't know. I would be curious to know exactly what the status of that is.
Yeah. So you're more tuned into this character than I am. Like, most of my familiarity comes from, you know, just general pop culture awareness of him and these two movies. Other than that, I'm not really familiar with Zorro. I haven't watched a lot of the movies or TV shows or read the story. So he's not a character I'm super invested in, but for someone like you, who's a bit more invested in this character, what would you like to see next from this character?
Well, that's a good question. I think, you know, the tendency is always to try and bring a character into the modern day, which I think would be an enormous mistake here. Zorro, the character, is very much a product of the time in which he was originally written. And I mean, when I say that, I mean the time in which his stories were originally set, which was the mid to late 1800s,
right?
As opposed to, I'm not talking about the time that the stories were written in the 1920s and beyond. I think the character has to stay there, because he is very much about the evolution of the West Coast, the West Coast territory or territories that became California. And you know, it just, he's very much about that. I consider him sort of like a 19th century Batman in some respects. He has been called, the real life Murrieta has been called the Robin Hood of California.
Right.
I think, you know, whatever gets done next, I would want it to stay in the time period in which the character was originally conceived, because he's very much about that part of, you know, the evolution of California and Mexico, and to take him out of that and put him somehow in the modern day, or make his great-great-grandson, who is now, you know, fighting bad guys in Arizona or New Mexico. I just think that would be a bad idea. So I guess I'm telling you what I don't want to see. I'm not sure what, you know, more specifically what I would want to see, but I at the very least, I would want him to stay in the period in which he was originally conceived.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it wouldn't make a whole lot of sense to when you have so many other analogs in a modern day setting of Zorro. So I don't really know what he would add to that if you brought him into a modern day setting.
Right. He'd essentially be Batman, I think.
Right. Yeah.
In some respects.
One thing I would definitely want to see is after reading about it, and I haven't read this comic book, but I think the Django Zorro thing is really interesting. I think that would be really cool to kind of see, like, if they could get Banderas back and have him teaming up with Jamie Foxx's Django. I think that would be really interesting to see on the big screen.
Well, and I think whenever you take a historical, a fictional character in a specific historical chapter of history, mm-hmm. whenever you can connect that character to actual historical figures, as was done in this film,
yeah,
that's always intriguing to me. It's like, you know, can you connect this fictional characters to people and events that were actually in existence and taking place at that time? That's when I think it gets really interesting when your piece of fiction and your fictional character are moving through time against a backdrop of events that really did happen in the history books that we know that we read. That's when I find, you know, that's really good storytelling, I think.
I think too, something I would like to see is beyond the Django team up idea is just and this ties into what you're saying about the history of it, is tying into a lot of, you know, anti-colonials type themes. I think that's something that's really embedded in the character. And it's not something that I don't think is really, at least from my understanding, it's not something that's really played up a lot. So I think I'd be really interesting to see something that plays more into those types of themes and focuses on those aspects of it too.
Yeah, I think, you know, the one of the premises of this movie is that, you know, Diego de la Vega, the Anthony Hopkins character, he is a Spanish born nobleman, mm-hmm. who's fighting against the Spanish. He's fighting against his own people in the Mexican War of Independence. So like, that, I find that interesting. It's just basically, he is just, in a sense, he is sort of renounced his own heritage, mm-hmm. because he believes strongly enough in this new world and the people who inhabit it, that he's willing to fight against his own people as part of that, you know, as part of that experience.
Something that's also interesting that this movie does is because, you know, in a way that's kind of a white savior narrative, because you got the European guy coming in to save the poor indigenous people. But
right.
This, in a way, it kind of flips it, but it kind of doesn't, because you got a Spaniard playing Alejandro. But it is that same type of idea where you've got a Mexican character taking up the mantle. And I think that's a really cool aspect of the character.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, basically, the mentor is a Spaniard, mm-hmm. but the protege is a Mexican.
It's
an interesting cultural balance there, considering what was going on at that point in history.
Yeah,
in that region of the world. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. See, I think playing up some of those aspects, I think, would definitely be interesting. Bring back this idea of, you know, Mexican independent taking up the mantle of Zorro. I think would be pretty interesting too, something like that, mm-hmm. and have it played by an actual Mexican guy instead of a Mexican.
I think that's a lot more likely to happen now than it was 25 years ago when this film was made.
Well, I think I don't think this movie gets made unless you have the kind of talent behind it. Like, unless you have Antonio Banderas signing on, unless you have Anthony Hopkins signing on, I don't think this movie gets made.
No, I think you're right. I think there's a whole conversation around that that we don't need to get into. But yes, I think you're absolutely right. I think there's still some reticence on the part of Hollywood to go there. Less so now than maybe 25 years ago.
Yeah.
Or certainly in 1940 when Tyrone Power, who's about as white as it gets, played the role. But there is still some reticence. But I think we're moving in a direction where you might be more likely to see it than you were.
Yeah. Okay, John. Anything you want to promote before we close up here?
Wow. I would just re-promote what I mentioned last time I was on the podcast. We had just released, when I say we, I'm talking about Flinch Books, I am one half of Flinch Books, which is a small press operation based here in Ohio. It's myself in Cleveland It's my partner, Jim Beard, in the Toledo area. We are both writers and editors. And our latest project, last time we talked on this show, Perry, was an anthology called Blood on the Blade. It's a sword and sorcery anthology. It had just come out at the 1st of December. And 2.5 months later, it's still doing very well. It's a really nice collection. It's getting a lot of good response on Amazon and Goodreads. 10 stories of slashing swords and sinister sorcery. 10 really great authors that we assembled. And as I say, it's doing well, getting a lot of good reviews. We're still very happy about it. That is really like our latest project out of the chute is that. And I will also say that I am currently working on the third book in the Midnight Guardian series, which should be out. And I say this with fingers crossed, should be out by August. So that's the hope right now. I'm knocking wood as I say that, but that is my current project. And I'm working feverishly to get that done and have that out by late summer.
So okay.
Those are the hot projects right now.
Okay, great. For my part, if you're on Amazon, if you're using the Kindle Vella program, which I think is only open to people in the US right now, I do have a sci-fi serial called Corsairs. You can find that out, information about that on PercivalConstantine.com. And as for this show, SuperheroCinephiles.com is the website, Super Cinema Pod on both Twitter and Instagram. And please be sure to like and review us on Apple Podcasts or anywhere you get your podcasts. John, thanks so much for coming on. We'll have to have you come back on again some point.
I appreciate it. Look forward to it. Anytime.
Thank you. Okay, that does it for us, and we will talk to you next time. You have been listening to the Superhero Cinephiles podcast. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Super Cinema Pod. Join our Facebook group by searching for Superhero Cinephiles, where you can interact with us and other superhero fans. If you'd like to support the show, you can become a regular supporter at Patreon or make a one-time donation through PayPal, both of which can be found at our website, SuperheroCinephiles.com. If you buy or rent any movies through the Amazon links at our site, it helps support the show. Please be sure to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts.
Thank you for listening. And as always, good night, good evening, God bless.